in full. Daniel chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belshazzar. The message was true and was about a great conflict. He understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 full weeks. I didn't eat any rich food, no meat or wine entered my mouth, and I didn't put any oil on my body until the 3 weeks were over. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there was a man dressed in linen with a belt of gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like topaz, his face like the brilliance of lightning, his eyes like lightning torches, his arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Only I, Daniel, saw the vision. The men who were with me did not see it, but a great terror fell on them, and they ran and hid. I was left alone looking at this great vision. No strength was left in me. My face grew deathly pale, and I was powerless. I heard the words he said, and when I heard them, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Suddenly a hand touched me and raised me to my hands and knees. He said to me, "Daniel, you are a man treasured by God. Understand the words that I'm saying to you. Stand on your feet, for I have now been sent to you." After he had said this, I stood trembling. "Don't be afraid, Daniel," he said to me. "For from the first day that you purposed to understand and humble yourself before your God, your prayers were heard. I've come because of your prayers. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia opposed me for 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me after I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I have come to help you understand what will happen to your people in the last days, for the vision refers to those days." While he was saying these words to me, I turned my face toward the ground and was speechless. Suddenly, one with human likeness touched my lips. I opened my mouth and said to the one standing in front of me, "My Lord, because of the vision, I am overwhelmed and powerless. How can someone like me, your servant, speak with someone like you, my Lord? Now I have no strength. There's no breath in me." Then the one with human likeness touched me again and strengthened me. He said, "Don't be afraid, you who are treasured by God. Peace to you. Be very strong." As he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, "Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me." He said, "Do you know why I've come to you? I must return at once to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I leave, the prince of Greece will come. No one has the courage to support me against them except Michael, your prince. However, I tell you what is recorded in the book of truth. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to strengthen and protect him. Now I will tell you the truth. This chapter, Pastor Jared walked us through a couple of weeks ago. If you're a guest with us, we're going through the book of Daniel, and we have been for much of 2022. And we find ourselves here in chapter 11 and recognize that what we have in chapter 11 is the content of the revelation the angel gives to Daniel. And this prayer of Daniel and his intercession, his seeking of God, is answered in chapter 10. And he begins to be involved in this relationship of angelic beings and receive the content of this revelation that is unpacked in chapter 11. And we'll be looking at a portion of this today, about two-thirds of the chapter. Next week, we'll come back and finish the last portion of Daniel 11, a longer chapter with this content that will then progress into chapter 12. As Pastor Jared mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Daniel 10 through 12 is this final unit, really, of the book of Daniel, chapter 12, sort of summarizing some themes and looking even further forward, though the end of chapter 11, as we'll see next week, does a bit of that. In chapter 11, here, beginning in verse 1 and progressing again through about two-thirds of the chapter, we have this initial phase of the revelation. And what we have here is the retelling of some of the ideas that we've seen already in Daniel from chapter 2 and chapter 7 and chapter 8, but a specification of it. And this is one of the features of this kind of literature in the Bible. It's often referred to as apocalyptic kind of literature, where there's a dualism. And Pastor Jared mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. There's a heavenly arena and an earthly arena, and what's happening on each of these, it can be described in its own arena, but there are connections between the two, and we'll see that even today, and how what takes place in heaven is affecting what's going on earth and the international scope of life on earth, and God's sovereignty in both domains. What is consistent in the heavenly arena and the earthly arena is that God is reigning, and He is reigning in such a way as to patiently demonstrate His greatness. And for many of us, when we just come to the plain reading of the text, this is what most challenges us. We believe in God. We believe in His sovereignty. We believe in His greatness and power. We believe that He is the Creator God. We could walk back further in the Old Testament and start in Genesis chapter 1 and confess in an orthodox fashion that our God created out of nothing. He spoke and it existed all the way in 6 days. Further, we believe that He is the God of life. He created life and He demonstrated that power not only in Adam and Eve, but in the flow of the Bible. He demonstrated it to a really old couple, Abraham and Sarah, so that they had a baby when it was obvious that they were beyond the age of having children. So much so that their son is named Isaac. He laughed. It's laughable. It's laughable that someone in our old age could conceive. And God did that so that Israel would know from that day forward that they are a supernatural people. Their very existence as a nation began with God intervening. We could progress further in the Old Testament. Think about the Exodus. My, over and over, the Lord, through Moses, demonstrating His great power over all kinds of natural phenomena and ultimately death, leading His people out of Egypt, plundering the Egyptians so they would have wealth. carrying them along in miraculous ways through the wilderness. We could go on and on through the Old Testament and think about God's mighty acts and how he can act in an instant to accomplish his will, and no one can thwart him. Isn't this what we believe? Isn't this Orthodox Christianity? So what sometimes becomes problematic for us is that this God, who is that mighty and powerful and can act in an instant, is patient. It seems to us inconsistent. Come on. Because at the human level, we think if X person can accomplish this task with this degree of ease and efficiency, why don't they do that all the time? This just makes sense to us. So we think of God and all his greatness. Why doesn't he always just act with this kind of efficiency? And this is where, brothers and sisters, we have to expand our thoughts of orthodoxy and remember that God is not a man. To be sovereign over time does not mean that efficiency is the bottom line. We want things to be efficient, but that is not God. And we see that unpacked throughout the Old Testament as well. And if we allow ourselves to think broadly today from Daniel 11, as we will the first section of the text and next week further, we will see that God is patiently demonstrating his sovereignty, in which he could act in a moment to fulfill all of his will and plans. He is patiently demonstrating his sovereignty over nations that he has scattered people groups with their own ethnicity, their own natural combative tendencies of war and rising and falling. He is sovereign over all of that, patiently waiting until we get to the New Testament. What did Paul tell the Galatians? In the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son. It was the fullness of time when Jesus was born, when he suffered, when he rose. And it will be in the Father's timing that Jesus returns to consummate his rule and kingdom that is now operating around the world amongst all kinds of peoples through the church. And this is what God wants to show off. This is the point. This is why we read Ephesians 3 earlier. This is Paul's grid. This is what fueled him. Paul got history and he got theology. He knew the Old Testament. He knew the sequence. He knew God's mighty acts. He understood the nation's history and all that had come about. And he understood God's greatness. And he understood that he was living in the day, in fact, a special called apostle to proclaim this message that God in the church is bringing all kinds of people together to show off his greatness to the angelic realms that we will be reading about in Daniel 11. That God in his patience is now showing off to these angelic beings his great power in the church, in Jesus' death and resurrection, Jesus now reigning over them, ruling through his kingdom, his people, through all nations. This is the mystery now revealed. And that's the church. You may be a guest today with us in learning about churches. You may be a younger person, and you may have been in this building, in this room, weekly for years, maybe in decades. And today, I want you to understand, every person, whether you've been here decades or this is the first day that you have been here, I want you to understand that God values the church. The local assembly, all local assemblies across time, this is the special people that have been called out of all nations through the blood of Christ to represent the greatness of what he has done and to show that off. Listen, every time a local church gathers, God is showing off. The Lord's Day is the day God sort of shows it off again as people gather together. Look at what only I can do. Look what I've done. This is God showing off in his patience, his sovereign plan, slowly. Not just decade after decade or century after century, but millennia after millennia until the coming of Christ. And since then, two millennia of God showing off, look what I've done, look what I've done. Brothers and sisters, my hope today is that we would understand how God views the church as his means, his body to show off his greatness, and we would appreciate it likewise. Once we are gripped with the reality of what God has revealed about himself, we'll be gripped with the glory of the local church. Those just go together. It's not possible to be just overwhelmed by the greatness of God and not recognize the special nature of the local church. We'll be thinking about those ideas today. And a part of that is going to be unpacked in Daniel 11, verses 1 through 35. We will look just at the first two-thirds of the chapter today and notice how God here, in the flow of the Old Testament to the New, this is one dot in the connected series of dots of God's revelation of himself. And here we have this window of the heavenly realm, the earthly realm, and these ideas coming together in the patience of God to reveal himself in anticipating the coming of Christ. We'll see that God rules over these successive movements of history in verses 3 through 20, and then focus our attention on one particular leader and entity, one particular nation and leader in the ancient world, and how God's people, those who returned from the exile, had to suffer for their faith and their commitment. Our question today, how does the God of heaven demonstrate his rule on earth? God rules over the successive movements of history to position his people for testing and testifying to his kingdom. What we see here in the general description in verses 3 through 20 is unpacked specifically in ancient historical texts. I'll be quoting later from the historian Josephus, who lived in the first century. We could look at the Maccabean literature, Roman historian Polybius in the second century BC, writing about some of these very events that come to take place, as Daniel prophetically says they will in his writing here, and he hears from the angel. Notice with me in the text. We have already in chapter 10 this portrait of a relationship, as Psalm 82 and other places in the Old Testament play out, that in the heavenly realm there are angels, and those angelic beings have a relationship with international affairs on earth. And there seems to be this correspondence. Psalm 82, the psalmist bears this out, that there are these angelic figures in a council that God rules over. And this is a part of God's patient plan and the organizing of history. And what's fascinating, as you noticed already in Daniel 10, as I read it, even this angel who goes to speak to Daniel is delayed with this conflict going on. But that delay is censured by who? Michael, Daniel's angel, who, when the Lord sends him, it's an instant fix. So there's God's allowing these activities to carry on in his sovereignty and at specific moments, i.e. the period of days that are the delay here until this angel arrives to help Daniel? Exactly. So there's conflict, and yet there's supremacy. As soon as Michael wants something done, it's done. It's God's sovereignty and the special nature of Israel in the case at hand. So with this in mind, verse 1 of Daniel 11, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to strengthen and protect him. This is this angel. Again, we've seen throughout the book of Daniel, the end is not yet. The end is not yet. So if the end is not yet, that means logically something has to be taking place until the end. And those events are in a connected sequence that God is supreme over. This is God's patient allowing of nations to demonstrate rule on earth that he ordains and allows, and it's even going to lead suffering for his people. We've seen in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8 the sequence of leaders. And we come to some specific ones here. Remember, in Daniel 2, in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, there are four nations represented: Babylon, the Medes and Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans. In chapter 7 and chapter 8, those ideas come up again. And here in chapter 11, there's a specification now on the Medes and Persians and then the Greeks and what's going to follow after them and the specific physical and animistic elements that represent them are detailed in chapters 2, 7, and 8, and the nations just referenced here. There's a specification from symbolic to specific. So notice the text. The Medes and Persians here, representing in Daniel 2, it's the silver chest, and then we have the bear in chapter 7, the ram in chapter 8, and Daniel begins to hear about them in Daniel 11 here in verse 2. Now I will tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia. Again, in Daniel 2, the Persians, this is that silver chest. It's the bear in chapter 7. It's the ram in chapter 8. And now a specification. It's this nation, the Persians. The fourth king, verse 2, will be far richer than the others. By the power he gains through his riches, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Now we have another specific nation mentioned, and it's this kingdom of Greece in chapter 2 that's represented by a bronze stomach and thighs. This is the leopard of chapter 7, the goat of chapter 8, and here Alexander the great Greek king, warrior who will come. Notice the text in verse 3. Then a warrior king will arise. And Daniel, again, prophesying of this well before Alexander the Great comes onto the scene, and he is a great warrior king. We can look at any number of ancient historians who write about him. In 11 years, he essentially conquers much of the world of his day. A great warrior king. He'll rule a vast realm, verse 3. He'll do whatever he wants. And what is fascinating here is the specificity. It's very brief, but this really is the heading of Alexander the Great's rule. He came on quickly. He really did do whatever he wanted. It was an 11-year reign. It was not that long, but he conquered so much of the world of his day. But one of the other factors, just reading histories about Alexander the Great, was, boy, like many stars in our day, quick rise, equally quick fall. That's exactly what it was. Verse 4, but as soon as he is established, verse 4, his kingdom will be broken up. Brothers, this is exactly a summary of Alexander the Great's rule. This Greek king, again, represented by the bronze stomach and thighs, the leopard of chapter 7, the goat of chapter 8. His kingdom will be broken up, verse 4, and divided to the four winds of heaven, but not to his descendants. It will not be the same kingdom that he ruled, because his kingdom will be uprooted. and will go to others besides them. It wasn't Alexander the Great's descendants, it was his generals. Just as in our day, when a magnificent leader falls, what often happens? There's infighting, some kind of civil war, and that kingdom is broken up, and that's exactly what happens here. And in Daniel 11 here, beginning in verse 5 and going through verse 19, what we have is a general description of about 150 years of history from the time of 320 when Alexander the Great dies until the rise of Antiochus the Fourth in about 175 when he begins to rule. This 150-year time period described generally here. And what you see is that the infighting, the back and forth between the north and the south, the intermarriages, which are common in that day. Master's kids, just this morning, you were reading about Solomon becoming king, and he took a wife from the Egyptians to solidify that relationship and in his rule. That same phenomenon is happening generations later right here, a northern king taking an Egyptian wife and back and forth to try to solidify some peace between the two. What I want you to notice as we read through the successive military and political fortifications from verses 5 through 19 is over all of this, God is sovereign, and Daniel is generally describing what is going to take place. Verse 11, the king of the south, or verse 5 rather, the king of the south, that's the Egyptian, the Ptolemaic kingdom that will fight the Syrian or Seleucid kingdom of the north, these two kingdoms that are going to go back and forth. They're going to have commanders. One is going to rule for a time. Verse 6, after some years, there'll be an alliance. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to seal the agreement. She will not retain power. His strength will not endure. She'll be given up together with her entourage, her father, and the one who supported her during this time in the place of the king of the south. One from her family will rise up. Over and over, we have these successive rulers in the north and the south and this fighting. And what we need to recognize, if you'll just go forward with me to verse 14, and notice the specific message Daniel, remember, beloved of God, treasured by God. Verse 14, in those times many will rise up against the king of the south, violent ones, verse 14, among your own people will assert themselves. This reference to among your own people provides us a geographic anchor. We need to understand that these kingdoms of north and south here, described in verses 5 through 20, between them is the promised land. This is the land of Judah. This is the land where the exiles get to go back to. So what we have here, as these kings traverse back and forth, sometimes by sea in the Mediterranean, but most often by land, they go through the land of Israel. Israel is a land bridge between Egypt and the Syrian kingdom in the north, and this back and forth. And right there, God's people are caught between these. That's going to be important in just a few moments. But even here, notice, these people are involved, and they begin to take up arms and fight. Through verse 20, over and over again, there's the back and forth, north and south, success in the north, destruction in the south, success in the south, destruction in the north, intermarriage again. All of this over and over again for about 150 years. Until verse 21. Verse 21 begins the reference of a specific leader who will be the person in focus through verse 35. This is not a new figure. In Daniel chapter 8, Daniel has already understood this figure will arise, and he, in the midst of all these general kinds of leaders we read about, this one is going to have God's people in his crosshairs. in the midst of all the coming and going, the back and forth, now let's narrow our focus a little bit more, because one of these leaders is going to come against Jerusalem, against the temple, against God's people. That is, against the exiles who are back from Babylon, their descendants here. And Daniel sees this. Verse 21, in his place, a despised person will arise. Royal honors will not be given to him, but he will come during a time of peace and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Many leaders in the ancient world became leaders through military might. They just fought and won, and then they ruled. Political alliance, if they had money or wealth or dynasty, they could make some kind of alliance, maybe through intermarriage, maybe through some economic pact and these different kinds of arrangements, but not this figure. It's intrigue. Joe Sprinkle, a commentator, I value his work on the book of Daniel, writes about Antiochus beginning here and going forward. Daniel 11, 21 to 35 describes the greatest enemy of the Jewish people and threat to their religion during the intertestamental period. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes reigned from 175 to 164, very short reign, just 11 years. Daniel already prophesied about him in chapter 8, verses 9 to 14 and 23 to 26. His title, Epiphanes, can mean manifest, and it was often thought to be a blasphemous name, the manifest presence of God. According to classical historians, Antiochus Epiphanes was an utterly unpredictable personality. At one moment, he appeared to be a capable, energetic administrator, a shrewd tactician, and a man of great generosity. At another moment, he became fiercely tyrannical and unstable, a madman. Perhaps his treatment of the Jews. It's not unnatural, then, for folks to make correspondence between Antiochus and Nero, the Roman leader. Both very unstable in this ways, both coming after God's people. This takes us then to his actions and the suffering that's going to come. Verses 22 through 24 provide us a brief account of what takes place in his days, and then it becomes more specific in verses 29 and following after that. Notice verse 22, a flood of forces will be swept away before him. They'll be shattered. Again, he's not a great militant. It's just like they're being swept away. An alliance is made with him, and he'll act deceitfully. He'll rise to power with a small nation. During a time of peace, he'll come to the richest parts of the province and do what his fathers and predecessors never did. He'll lavish plunder, loot, and wealth on his followers and make plans against fortified cities, but only for a time. With a large army, then, he'll stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. So he's in the north, coming to the south. The king of the south will prepare for battle with an extremely large and powerful army, but he will not succeed because plots will be made against him. Those who eat his provisions will destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will be slain. The two kings whose hearts are bent on evil, that is, the king of the north here, Antiochus, and the corresponding king in the south, the king of Egypt at the time, speak lies at the table to no avail. For still, this is the important point for us, verse 27, the final phrase, in terms of our understanding of God. The end will come at the appointed time. Brothers and sisters, all of this is taking place in God's patience. He is not sovereign because he's patient. You just have to let that settle in your mind. Sometimes we think sovereignty means instantaneous action. Can be, but sovereignty can be patient, letting people play out according to their natural instincts of war. And that's what's happening even here. The king of the north will return to his land with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action, then he returned to his own land. What is fascinating is that verse 28 and into verses 29 through 35 that we're going to see in the remainder of our time here with this great specification, What Daniel prophesies is exactly what we read about in the history books. I'll quote Josephus here in a few moments, and you can see what Josephus writes in the first century is what Daniel predicts well before these events take place. The specific kind of action, and here's what it is. In the north, Antiochus, one more time, wants to go and attack the south and take it over. He thinks he can now rule the whole area. This has been a back and forth, and now he's coming back to it. And remember, when he goes south, what does he travel through? He travels through the land of Israel. Yeah, if someone is going from Nebraska to Oklahoma, what do they go through? Kansas. This is the way it is. This is going to be the route. So he's going through Israel, and what is fascinating here is that he will soon turn on the people of Israel. And what Daniel predicts in chapter 8 begins to take place. And what he learns will take place here in chapter 11, in fact, does. The angelic message in chapter 8 and the angelic message here in chapter 11 are in exact correspondence. Verse 29. At the appointed time, he will come again to the south. Again, we don't have the mention of Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, but this general description fits exactly this individual. But this time will not be like the first, verse 29. Ships of Kittim will come against him, and being intimidated, he will withdraw. This ships of Kittim is hard to know exactly who the historical referent Daniel might have in mind is, but it seems to specify exactly to the Romans, because what happens is when Antiochus comes to Egypt to attack it, the Romans intervene. They are sick of the back and forth, and now they're ruling, and they want Antiochus to stay in the north. They want the king of Egypt to be stabilized, so he comes. And the historians write that when this Roman emissary comes and confronts Antiochus in Egypt after a battle, and Antiochus is rebuffed and frustrated, the Roman emissary is dialoguing, and Antiochus says, "Can I go and ask my advisors for help? Can I go seek other help?" And the Roman, the appointed emissary from Rome, draws a circle around Antiochus with his walking stick and says, "You can consult everyone inside of this circle." He's publicly humiliated. You have a tyrant who's publicly humiliated, and his actions, they are right here in Scripture and in the history books. Daniel chapter 11, ships of Kittim, which we would interpret the Romans who came from Rome south by ship to Egypt, will come against him. Being intimidated, he will withdraw. Then he will rage. Notice this, verse 30. He will rage against the Holy Covenant and take action. On his return, he will favor those who abandon the Holy Covenant. His forces will rise up and desecrate the temple fortress. They will abolish the daily sacrifice and set up the abomination of desolation. This is exactly what Antiochus did in the temple. With flattery, he will corrupt those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will be strong and take action. Those who are wise among the people will give understanding to many, yet they will die by sword and flame and be captured and plundered for a time. When defeated, they'll be helped by some, but many others will join them insincerely. Some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. What we need to recognize is the reference to the appointed time and the time of the end. Here, iterating earlier in the chapter, here referenced twice. God's sovereignty is completely consistent with his patience. And while he is patient, what is happening? International conflict is being allowed even to test and refine his people right here. This is exactly what Antiochus did and what we read about. Josephus says, book 12 of his Antiquities of the Jews. Antiochus, upon the agreeable situation of the affairs of his kingdom, resolved to make an expedition against Egypt. He desired to gain it. He made haste to Alexandria in hopes of taking it by siege, subduing the king there and reigning there. But he was driven not only from Alexandria, but out of all Egypt by the declaration of the Romans, who charged him to let that country alone. King Antiochus, returning out of Egypt for fear of the Romans, made an expedition against the city of Jerusalem. The king came up to Jerusalem and, pretending peace, he got possession of the city by treachery. In order to plunder its wealth, he ventured to break the league he had made with it. He emptied it of its secret treasuries and left nothing at all remaining, and by this means cast the Jews into great lamentation, for he forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer to God according to the law. When he had pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive together with their wives and children. So the multitude of those captives that were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. He burnt down the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was high and overlooked the temple, on which account he fortified it with high walls and towers. However, in that citadel dwelt the impious and the wicked of the Jewish multitude. When the king had built an idol altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship of the country. He compelled the people to forsake the worship that they paid to their own God, and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day. It wasn't just that Antiochus was content to offer pigs on God's altar in Jerusalem. He wanted pigs offered everywhere. This is what God allowed to happen in his sovereignty, coming against his people. This is Antiochus. This is God's patience. Notice the end, the appointed time, verse 25. Do you see it again? Still, the end will come at an appointed time. Verse 35, for it will still come at the appointed time. And along the way, here in this instance, the people of God suffer. We will see this unpacked thematically in Revelation in much of 2023. If you're a guest with us, we're going through Daniel, and Revelation will be next, starting in a few weeks, and then in the holiday series, and then into 2023, and going through Revelation, seeing this very idea that God's sovereignty sometimes means instantaneous action, often means patient action, and activities are happening on earth. If we have those two ideas set before us, what we conclude from those is that during that patient activity of God and his allowing of things to play out on earth, sovereignly ruling over them, but people acting according to their own character, God's people will often suffer. In fact, we read this morning in Ephesians 3 that very idea. Did you catch that? Paul writing about this mystery, God's patience, now the people of God in Christ, united together of many nations, sealed by the Spirit. This is God's activity. And Paul concludes, don't feel bad. This, my suffering for this is your glory in it. And this will happen for us as well. That's one of the reasons why we need each other and why church fellowship is so important. Because to be God's people means that the world is going to be against us. Now, certainly, we need to do all that we can. We need to be circumspect in our lives so the world doesn't come against us for our foolishness or our own arrogance or sin. But it will come against us simply for being God's people, for holding to truth, for holding to standards. And because of that, you need other believers. I said today that I hope two factors result from this sermon. One, realize God's value of the church, his patience until the coming of Christ, gathering us together in the blood of Christ by the Spirit. This is what we read about, this mystery revealed to the heavens. And second, that we would more value the church. And listen, you will find throughout history that when people suffer for their faith, they do value it because they need it. There's a sense in which fellowship is fuel. And if you are going to be a consistent witness in the world, you're going to need the body. If you're a guest with us, we are in the midst of a fellowship emphasis season. And a part of our emphasis is when we partake of the Lord's Supper, specifically thinking about our church fellowship and one another. If the musicians who will be accompanying us during the Lord's Supper would come. In 1 Corinthians 11, when Paul writes about the Lord's Supper, he urges the church not to take in vain, not to go about the partaking of the Lord's Supper without looking to those around them and their needs and how they can participate in that and share in fellowship. To remember the body, Paul writes, is to remember the body of Christ broken, his physical flesh is torn for us, but also the people around us, that we would remember them and think about them and that we are members with them, what needs they have, how we can participate, how we can encourage them. At MCC, this is something we want to do, and it's something we need to discipline ourselves to do. We need to be thoughtful about each other. What can I do to help this person? How can I, with what God has given me, participate in God's work in their life? How can I encourage? How can I support? How can I pray? So today, as we partake in just a few moments, I'm going to be reading the name of three families of our church for us to focus our prayers on today. If you would open the cellophane. And you have the cracker there. And as you're holding that cracker, our Walk Worthy Ministry for Children is going through the New City Catechism. And a question I've referenced repeatedly the last several weeks, I wish to do again here. The Catechism asks, what is the church? Listen to this as Daniel 11, Ephesians 3, ruminate in the back of your mind. God chooses and preserves for himself a community elected for eternal life and united by faith, who love, follow, learn from, and worship God together. God sends out this community to proclaim the gospel and prefigure Christ's kingdom by the quality of their life together and their love for one another. Let's eat in remembrance of Christ. How can you show love to Jim and Diane Langdon? Pray for them as you partake. Remember Dennis Matthews. What can we do to encourage him in Christ? Lift up JC and Julia Morrison and their family. What can we do to serve and love them? If you would open up the foil. This juice representing Jesus' blood. It's this blood that shows the specialness of the church. Let's drink in remembrance of Christ. If the rest of the musicians would join us as we continue in musical worship.